Group meeting, Saturday, 18th June 1988. You may recall that last time we were concerned with a very important point indeed. The question, who was Krishna? People, of course, think of him as a particular individual who was the teacher. But I'm quite certain that it was the author of the Gita who happened to have the name Krishna personally, was representing himself in the state of holistic consciousness. And you may remember I quoted one particular verse attributed to Krishna in the Gita in which the hint is given as to that point. Of the children of Vrishni, I am Krishna. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. Of among seers in silence, I am Vyasa. Among poets, I am Ushana. Now, that's an extremely important point. I suppose the whole of the Hindu world would quite disbelieve what I say on this matter, but I am quite certain about it. See, in the state of holistic consciousness, one can function in the context of infinity and eternity. There is no such thing as otherness. In this transcendent consciousness, one can be anybody else living in the world, present or in the past or in the future. This is one of the implications of the context of infinity and of eternity. And when Krishna himself says four different things, of the sons of Vrishni, I am Krishna. His father, he was the son of his father and mother and was named Krishna. And his full name was Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa. Krishna means dark colored. He came from Western India, from Dwarka, which is near in Gujarat, and the people of that district are somewhat dark skinned as compared with the Purus and the Pandavas, the Kurus and the Pandavas. So Krishna, dark. Dvaipayana means island born on an island. And Veda Vyasa, the compiler of knowledge. Veda is ordinarily translated as knowledge. But as far as the scriptures, the Hindu scriptures are concerned, Veda means not just knowledge, it means transcendent wisdom and knowledge and complete insight. He is the knowing one in the transcendent sense. And who is the knowing one in the transcendent sense for most of the world? God. You see? The whole idea of God as such emerged out of those remarkable people who, through living the pure life, realized holistic consciousness within the last maybe 6 or 7, or most perhaps 8,000 years. You see, because the practice of yoga, for instance, was known as far back as 5,000 years before Christ. In the civilization of Mohenjo-daro and Harappa, there are little, what do you call them, things made of Vishnu sitting in the yogic posture, and there are various representations like that. So people who practiced yoga in those days were able to enter profounder and profounder states of consciousness. Profounder meaning not higher or deeper or anything like that, although one constantly uses the word higher or deeper, but more and more intense states of consciousness. Our ordinary state of consciousness in the world is limited to the finite and the temporal. Things, objects, events, circumstances, people, animals, and so on. It's limited to that, you see. But as one's consciousness becomes more and more intense, it becomes an unlimited consciousness, ultimately, as far as the whole of manifestation is concerned. Do remember that. As far as the whole of manifestation is concerned. And also, it transcends the limitations of time, past, present, future. It doesn't know those limitations. So, in the Gita, you find the teacher who is named Krishna, who, as I say, is the author of the Gita himself. He says that of the seers in silence. This is the real key to it. The seers in silence. The munis, as they are called. M-U-N-I-S. Muni is the silent one. Mauna is the noun which means silence. Mauna. And muni is he who is the silent one. And this silence is realized when, through living the truly religious life, the pure life, that particular individual completely transcends the clutter, the noise of all our ordinary conscious activity. Our thinking, feeling, speaking and doing is a noise, more or less. And then in that state, the brain stops talking. This is the important point. The brain stops talking. When such a person, a muni, speaks, then his speech is prophetic speech. That is not just speech which tells you that there will be a cricket match next year on the 5th of July or something like that. It is not that sort of prophecy. It is prophecy in this sense, that he who listens and truly attends to what is being said, he will be so influenced, so impressed, that he himself will develop along the lines which will release this holistic transcendent consciousness. That is the main purpose of the existence of the human species, the fundamental species, I mean, the fundamental purpose. It is towards that end, that goal, if you like to use the word goal, that the human race is evolving. But to this day, after all, we are very young, only 3.5 million years old or so. When we have reached our real maturity, our real adulthood as the human species, there will be many and many people who will have this transcendent holistic consciousness. So, amongst the seers in silence, I am Vyasa, Veda Vyasa, Vyasa, the compiler of the scriptures, of that which is said or written, which is truth itself. See, in a sense, the claim made by the theistic religions and other religions too, that their scriptures are the word of God, is a true saying. Only, I wonder how many out of the millions who say that and believe that, you see, really understand what it implies and what it means. And this is an extremely profound matter, because if you and I can see that, first of all, of course, only intellectually, but if we can really penetrate into that, we will understand the purpose of our own personal existence, why we are here, and towards what we are growing. You see? And if we can really see that, and not only see it, but feel it with our whole heart, suddenly it comes to my mind, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul. Loving with all your heart and all your soul is seeing this kind of thing. If we do that, we shall be lights. We shall be sources of benediction to the whole human race. Because whatever you and I think, feel, speak and do affects not only ourselves and our particular environment, but it affects the consciousness of the whole of humanity. You might ask, well, what evidence have you for that? Well, I have no evidence to give you, but for what little I have seen for myself, I'm sure that that is the case. Interestingly enough, Krishnamurti also has emphasized that point, that your consciousness is not a separate something which is just yours. It affects the totality of the human race. And finally, among poets, I am Ushana. But Ushana flourished long before the days of the Gita. He was one of the Rig Vedic poets. Now, how can he say, I am Ushana? He means, the author of the Gita is a poet, of course, because the Gita is one of the loveliest poetical scriptures of the Hindus. So I am Ushana, I am the poet. And you all know how the finest scriptural writings are poetical in nature. They are poetic writings. So bear that point in mind, and especially bear it in mind in relation to yourself, the purpose of your existence, and what one has to work towards. Now, amongst the things that Krishna says, he says, I am the father of this universe. We have the idea of God the Father in all the theistic religions also. And the origin of the Father. Now that we haven't got in any other religion. The word which is used is Pita Maha, the Great Father. And as a matter of fact, most of scholars have translated that as the grandsire. I am using the translation which Juan Mascaro used. Now Mascaro is I wonder if he's still alive. I don't know. He was much older than I am. He was a Spanish mystic of the finest sort. And the Gita to him meant something which nothing else meant. Have you ever seen his translation of the Gita? You have. And you see what a poetic translation it is. And the origin of the Father. Now, his use of the word origin tells me that Huan must have been in a truly perceptive state. I find words difficult nowadays. Insight, a state of real insight. This is a true insight, the origin of the Father. Because the Father idea is a human presentation. Whether it is the truth is something which I think one cannot speak of. Because when we use the word Father, we know what Father means in our sense, in our human physical sense of Father, the male progenitor of me, of you. That's what we mean by Father. And we cannot avoid that conditioning of the meaning of Father to be plastered onto the idea of God, God the Father. We cannot help it. It's very interesting that in the early Christian mysticism, and also the writings of the fathers, Gnosticism, and certainly in the Hermetic, the Hellenistic form of the Hermetic teachings, God is presented as all Father mind. Now, where did this mind idea come from? Except from Asia, India particularly. All Father mind. So, I am the Father of this universe and the origin of the Father. And I have added on, out of affection for the great scholars, because I do have affection for them, though I am very critical of some of them, the great Father, the unnameable, transcendent. I put that in brackets. I am the mother and nourisher of this universe. Now, to me, this is the clear hint that the idea of the Creator is not limited to the male progenitor only. He is the father and the mother. He realizes that. This mother idea, of course, existed in ancient Egypt. Isis, Osiris, Horus, and all that sort of thing, you see. And I think it also existed in a milder form in the Greek pantheon and in the Scandinavian pantheon too. This mother is really nothing other than nature. In the Kabbalistic writings, we have from Ein Sof, the primordial origin, we have the first two emanations, Chochmah, which is wisdom, which is male. Now, wisdom in the religions ordinarily is presented as female, she, rather than he. But here in the Kabbalistic teachings, Chochmah is male, and so is Purusha, which is the correspondent in the Sankhya philosophy. It's male. And there is Bina, the counterpart, intelligence, which is the female. Now, the Kabbalistic teachings are extremely interesting. Chochmah, by sheer presence, so influences Bina that she, who represents the supreme intelligence, is both positive and negative, male and female. And Chokhmah, by his presence, so influences Bina that the male and the female elements play together and bring forth the material universe. Now this is extraordinarily deep perception. You see, if we can understand these things, we can understand so many other things also. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days in the land may be long, and so forth. The father and the mother are one and the same. The father and the mother who are responsible for all manifested creation. You see, beyond the manifested creation, there is, I'll come to that in Krishna's own words. When day comes, all that is made manifest, the day referring in this instance to the day of Brahma, the creator god of the Hindus. Brahma, Vishnu is the nourisher and sustainer, and Brahma, Vishnu and Rudra, Shiva, is mistakenly represented as the destroyer. He is not the destroyer. He is the one who changes things. He is the regenerator. So the old is transformed into the new. This is something which most of the Hindu world is still ignorant of. I don't know why. I'm not a Hindu by birth or by education or anything, but I have seen this as the real fact of Shiva. So the day of Brahma is, Brahma is the creative aspect of the creative energy. That's why nowadays, since the word God has become so loaded, and other words similarly have become loaded, I have preferred to use the word origin or transcendence. Transcendence not as a quality. When I use it as a quality, I have a simple T in the writings. And when I use transcendence in this sense of origin, the creative, the primordial creative origin, then I use a capital T. So when day comes, all that is made manifest streams forth from the unmanifest. That is to say, the unmanifest is not a separate something from the manifest. The totality is a unity. It's a unitary whole. Out of that unitary whole, through the influence of the origin, which wants to manifest itself, the desire to manifest itself, influences the unitary whole to become dual. Duality starts from the very beginning. In Zarathustrianism, in the Zarathustrian writings, curiously enough, the creation of the two spirits, the one which was called the Holy Spirit, Svanta Mainyu, and the other which was called Angre Mainyu, the hurt, I translate it as hurtful spirit, but they usually regard it as the evil spirit. Both of them come from Ahura Mazda, the one original source, you see. And there is another verse in the Gathas of Zarathustra which state that creation's purpose is fulfilled by the interaction of these two. Now how can the interaction of good and evil fulfill creation? The word evil is the mistake. It is not evil. It is that element of manifestation, in our own lives we know it, which is the challenge which circumstance throws to us. which everything throws to us, our own desires, our own ambitions, and so on. They all throw the challenge. And we have to learn how to not react according to the challenge, but to respond rightly to that challenge. And it is this which draws out the hidden wisdom and love in us, till finally it culminates in the transcendent love and transcendent wisdom, which spells the complete fulfillment of human existence. And all that is manifest dissolves into the unmanifest when night comes. That means that it returns to the state of quiescence. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that it is non-est, that it doesn't, it isn't there. It is there. But it is in a state of quiescence. If you grasp this, you will probably understand very deeply the meaning of the Sabbath day. In Genesis, 6 days for manifestation, and on the seventh day, the Sabbath. But the Sabbath is as much an eternity, is much eternity as all the previous so-called 6 days are eternity. Each one is eternity. You know, it's not easy to explain very logically these deep things. If you can sort of feel it out with the brain calm, and that is the difficulty. To get the brain calm, learn to be silent, said he who is always talking. You see, but I talk only when I have to talk. Otherwise I don't chatter uselessly. If the brain is quiet, then there'll be insight. And that will affect the brain in such a manner, in course of time, usually, not immediately, sometimes immediately, very rarely immediately, but in course of time, it will affect the brain in such a manner that the right kind of thought and word will emerge from you. So, I know someone who talks rather a lot, and the excuse given is that it is so unsocial not to be talking in company. It might be most profitably social to be silent as and when possible, wherever possible, to be silent. Because your silence has a calming influence upon the company. This is the great thing. Now, so, and all that is manifest dissolves into the unmanifest when night comes, the night of Brahma, God the Creator, the Sabbath day comes. But indeed, beyond this unmanifest, there is another, a timeless unmanifest, which lives eternally when all else within time's web passes away. You know, if you I'll tell you where this comes. This is in the 8th discourse, verses 18, 20 and 21. In the 8th discourse. These are profound things, but don't let the brain struggle to find out the meaning. Don't go for it with a sense of, with a desire for personal finding of personal achievement or attainment. That will defeat your purpose. Just be quiet and let it speak. If it doesn't speak today, it will speak tomorrow. The quiet is the requisite condition for this transcendent energy to work upon the brain and formulate what the truth is. So, beyond this unmanifest, there is another, a timeless unmanifest, which lives eternally. Now you see, it is statements like that which to me are the proof that he who wrote this was one who had realized holistic consciousness. He was the teacher whom the Hindus worship. But, especially in those days, it would have been a little bit unmodest to say, I teach you. And today too, it would be equally immodest to say that I am the teacher. Then the next verse states, that unmanifest which lives eternally is called the indestructible. It is called the last born. B-O-U-R-N, born. They who reach it return not. That is my supreme abode. Now what more proof do you want as to who the author of the Gita was? What sort of a person he was? He is the one who is represented as Krishna, God incarnate, by the Hindu world. And since he, a human being like you and me, born of a father and mother, and dark-skinned, if he realized that, you and I can realize it. But remember, don't confine it to just an intellectual level. So many thoughts, so many ideas. When we of course cannot avoid starting with the thought, with the idea. But when that thought and idea emerges out of the quiet, the calm, then it becomes true insight. Supposing there are thick black clouds obscuring the sun. And suppose a wind arises and blows away the clouds suddenly. What a brilliant light it is. Almost a blinding light. It is like that. The insight which emerges is like that. And then what you say is true. It is prophetic speech. And then he ends up, and this comes in the 14th discourse. I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal and imperishable. What an extraordinary affirmation to make. I am the abode of Brahman, the supreme absolute all, the immortal and imperishable. I, Krishna, am the abode of that. That means that I, Krishna, in holistic consciousness, am the source of the absolute all, the immortal and imperishable. In the theistic religions we say God sees everything, knows everything, is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. Meditate on those words. This is one of the finest presentations of what those words stand for. And remember that God spoken of there has to be God in reality, not the God which makes us say, what nonsense. And we are right when we say, what nonsense. Now, the truth which Krishna affirms, Arjuna sees and confirms. When the Holy One is in the I am state, you know, the I am statement first comes in Exodus, chapter 3, verse 14, when Moses asks Yahweh Elohim, who speaks out of the burning bush, when the Israelites ask me, who has sent you to deliver us from bondage in Egypt, say unto them, Ehye Asher Ehye. The first Ehye means I, Moses. The Israelites are asking me, I, Moses, am. Ehye means I am. Asher, that supreme I am, the other I am. Yahweh Elohim himself. The Jews have made a peculiar mistake in presenting Jehovah as purely masculine. Yahweh really is masculine, feminine combined. But I think that there will come modern Jewish scholars as excellent as Sholem, Professor Sholem. I wonder whether he's still alive. He's quite old now. Who will be able to show clearly that Yahweh means the masculine, feminine together. The positive, negative together. It's better to put it that way, because we talk of energy in terms of positive and negative. Positive electricity, negative electricity, the positive pole of a magnet, the negative pole, and so forth. You see? And that is a more inclusive way of talking and thinking than the male-female idea, or the good-evil idea. When the Holy One is in the I am state, during which there is perfect suspension of perception and feeling. Now this perception and feeling refers to the deepest perception and feeling which human beings are capable of. The psychophysical being undergoes a transformation. Transfiguration is a word used in this connection, for even the bodily appearance is different. You find, for instance, in the life of the Buddha, it is said how he was transfigured. You'll read it in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. When Ananda is asked to fetch some water for him to drink and so forth. And of course, there is the statement of Moses coming down from the Mount of the Lord. Mount of the Lord means the holistic conscious state. When he comes down from the Mount, his face was shining. I have myself seen in two or three instances in India this sort of shining face. belonging to some remarkable people. As it was said of Moses, the Buddha, Jesus, and of other holy ones, on returning to ordinary everyday consciousness, the impress of that harmony of transcendence, pure mind, and the natural man. The psychophysical organism is the natural man. When the psychophysical being is completely purified, then pure mind, the universal mind, functions through him. And in that functioning, transcendence itself manifests through the human. That is why the human kingdom is so important. And that is why in the Buddhist teachings, it is emphasized that it is great good fortune, in the spiritual sense good fortune, not in the multimillionaire sense, it is great good fortune to acquire a human birth. They say the usual translation is acquire, but I would rather question whether acquire is the right word in that context. It just happens. You see, in the old days, when they taught, they still accepted the idea of separateness. This person, that person, that person, and so on, for all the millions of persons. But I don't accept that idea at all. There is only one person, man. Mankind. You see? And mankind, in holistic consciousness, or any particular manifestation of mankind, which is the individual being whom we know, that if, when that particular manifestation realizes holistic consciousness, then transcendence itself manifests its own transcendence as perfect humanity. You get a perfect flower. Transcendence manifests its transcendence as that perfect flower. That is why I say that every single human being on the globe has his or her proper place. But he or she has to discover what that proper place is. Otherwise, that person will misuse just an awareness of capacity. So we get the evil ones in the world, people who have done terrible harm. Because they got a flash of that which is transcendent, and they identified the separate self with that flash. And in identifying the separate self with that flash, they become the devil, Lucifer. I hope this helps you to understand some of the deep things which we find in the scriptures, which often are repulsive to us because they don't appeal to brain and heart. And when that happens, transcendence, pure mind, and the natural man are in a unified state, the natural man confirms in verbal form that seen revelation, that heard truth. Veda Vyasa, as the living man in the world, expresses this voice and Vishnu and vision through the words he puts in the mouth of Arjuna.